Hello, what is the crack, and welcome to this week's Blind By podcast. Shout out to all my brand new listeners, mostly international boys and girls. What's the crack? If you're a new listener, I'd suggest you don't have to exactly go back to the very start, but I would suggest dipping into, I think we're on episode 105 or 106 now. So there's loads and loads of episodes, and I would suggest dipping back into them because they're on varied topics and this podcast isn't necessarily sequential. I had a class weekend there, did some live podcasts in Kilkenny and in Cork. They were fucking fantastic. Thank you to everyone for showing up and being sound. Some lovely fucking podcasts that I can't wait to share with you when I get the chance. Just a tiny plug for three gigs, live podcast that I have coming up next week on the 22nd, Sligo Live, still tickets available for that, and please come along to that if you're in Sligo. That's going to be good crack. And then the only other two that I'm going to give a big plug for, because do you know, these are almost sold out after I mentioned them about 2 weeks ago, but there's a few tickets left for Dublin. Because you're always asking me for Dublin podcasts. So, in Vicar Street on the 19th and the 24th of November, I have two live podcasts. And I think there's about 100 tickets left for each night. So go and get those if you'd like to come along to a live gig. So yeah, last week's podcast was about climate anxiety. I enjoyed doing it because, like, I like a podcast where I'd been getting a lot of DMs about climate anxiety, but people talking about their mental health being affected specifically by the climate. So I decided I'd address it, and I like to address queries and questions that ye give me, but it's about shit that I'm currently going through as well, because that means then for me, just by talking to ye, talking through my feelings around it, it allows me to process shit in the here and now. So I did enjoy it, even though a couple of people felt anxious around it. A couple of people felt anxious around the fact that I'd even spoken about climate anxiety, that it maybe is a bit too raw. I also read out a brand new short story from my book. My book, by the way, another little plug before we move on. My book of short stories, the new one, which is called Boulevard Wren, is going to be in shops on November 1st. But you can pre-order it. And if you pre-order it, you will be in with a shot to get a print of a drawing that I've done that is also signed by me. And there's only so many in existence. So if you pre-order my new book of short stories from eatons.ie, you, depending on whether they're gone already, but I don't think so, you'll get this exclusive print that's signed that no one else will have, and I won't be doing any more, alongside getting the book for the same price as it is when you buy it on November 1st. You can also go to Book Depository and Amazon if you want, but it's Boulevard Wren. Brand new book of short stories, writing it for the past 2 years, and holy fuck am I glad to not be writing something at the moment. I'm really enjoying not having that pressure. The only thing I have to worry about at the moment is doing my live gigs and doing this podcast, and I won't be taking any more creative projects on, I'd say, until 2020. I just want to have until before Christmas. I'm getting 1 or 2 days a week where If I have the available time, I can play video games. And I wasn't able to do that in a while. So I'm back playing video games in my underpants, and that's how I'm using my leisurely time. And it's a fine time of year to be doing it, because there's nothing better than a dark, cold evening outside and firing up the Xbox. It's enjoyable. It's the right time to be doing it. You get guilty when you do it in the summer, you know? So this week's podcast is It's going to be a hot takey podcast. Long-time listeners will know that I'm a huge fan of art. I'm a huge fan of art, painting, the history of art, trying to understand art. I fucking adore art. And I haven't done a podcast on art in a while, and a lot of people have been asking me to do another one. We've done podcasts on... One of the first podcasts was about Caravaggio. It was about the life of Caravaggio. It was a kind of a conspiracy theory that I had based on the life of Caravaggio, that the reason he used so much black in his paintings is because he was trying to be a cheapskate, and how that went on to influence the work of director Martin Scorsese. So there was a Caravaggio podcast. I did one on Impressionism, I believe. I did a podcast on William Hogarth and his, I think it was Hogarth's work, but against the backdrop of gin overtaking early Industrial Revolution English society. Then there was a podcast on performance art. I really enjoyed that one. Again, I don't know the names of these podcasts because I give each podcast quite a ridiculous name that has nothing to do with the title. So there you go. It's tradition that I fuck it. What am I going to do? If I was on radio or TV, they'd make me name the things properly. So fuck it. I'm going to name a podcast with whatever name comes to me. And if you want to find out what each podcast is about, the easiest way, just go onto Spotify. If you go onto Spotify, you flick through them, and I give a tiny little synopsis in the description of each one. But yeah, there was a performance art podcast about a guy called Chris Burden, who had his friend shoot himself, has a friend shoot him in the arm in the name of art, and he also nailed himself to a Volkswagen. So we spoke about performance art and understanding it, and understanding why it's important and why it's not just, because modern art in particular, it's really exclusive, and it annoys me because a lot of modern art, it's difficult to understand unless you're initiated into the language of art, unless you've studied art or really put some effort into it. A lot of modern art, the average person just goes, what the fuck are these idiots doing? You know? And I don't like that about modern art. I'm someone who, I like art to be democratized. I'm a fan of creativity, creative expression being a part of, like, literally everyone's fucking life. Not this idea of only artists create art. I think everybody should create some type of art as just part of existing. And it doesn't mean it has to be brilliant. It doesn't mean it has to go into a gallery. It doesn't even mean that it's good enough that you'd want to show your friend. But I do believe, based on the fact that all of us, every single fucking one of us as children, enjoyed colouring in, playing with crayons and building Lego. All of us had this creative free part of ourselves that needed to... Art is beautiful on an individual level, because ultimately what you're doing, right, and this can go for writing a song, painting something, knitting something, crafts, you know, kind of creating something that's visual or aural, or even prose, whereby you're using, you know, words, but the words create something that's, it's not just communication, it's something beyond it. It's important because what art does, what creative expression does, it allows us to process emotions that are going on inside us, right? A lot of our emotional world, whether it be fear, pain, anger, desire, fantasies, whatever, a lot of it kind of exists in the unconscious mind as this little feeling that you can't put words on and you can't visualize and you can't understand it. It's just there at the back of your head, like a little insect. And art allows all of us to process it and get that out in some way, in whatever way. This is why people who, you know, who haven't gone near crayons since they were two, pick up, we'll say, an adult colouring book, for instance, and they walk away from it after an hour feeling energised and feeling, you feel a sense of internal resolution. You feel as if something inside you has been resolved and you mightn't even know what it is. It's a sense of completion. And it's just, it's a weird thing about today's society that some of us leave that behind at about the age of five. And you're kind of broken into groups of people of you're good at art and you're not good at art, so you go and do something else. Whereas I believe all of us should be doing something. And you can throw it into the bin at the end if you want. Do you know, get yourself some fucking Lego, if you like. If that was your buzz when you were two, get some Lego for yourself and make something, whatever the fuck you want. Or get yourself some clay or marla or some paints or an instrument. And the most important thing, when you were doing that shit when you were two or three or four, you didn't care whether it was going to be good or bad. You really didn't. You're just doing it for the sake of doing it, because that's how children's brains work. So try and get back to that place. You're doing it for the sake of doing, not for the sake of having something good at the end. I mean, I often wonder, I think, because when you're like two or three and you make a little painting or you make a little song or you make something out of Lego, naturally the child goes to the parent and says, "Mammy, mammy, daddy, daddy, look what I did." And I'd say it's that reaction, it's that parental reaction. Depending on that is when we as little humans decide whether or not we should continue with art or not continue with it. Yeah, because you'd want to be a right prick of a parent if you're turning around to your two-year-old or three-year-old and saying that crayon drawing is shit. I think most parents, actually, if their toddler creates anything, Lego, painting, whatever the fuck, most parents are kind of just really happy and proud to see something that they created now engaging in a degree of cultural expression. So most parents would just think whatever the kid does is brilliant and fuck it up onto the fridge and say fair play to you. And it could look like shit, but no parent is going to tell the child. Actually, no, because I know I have friends. Now, no friend who's a parent will admit this, but I do have friends whose parents, like, actively did. If my friend will say showed a talent for music or painting, whatever, they were actively discouraged from a young age by the parent because the parent was terrified that their child would grow up to be an artist and therefore grow up with quite limited career opportunities. Because, you know, that's the case. You know, if in this world of commodification, trying to make it as a fucking artist in 2019, tough going, lads. So a lot of parents will react badly to a child showing creative tendencies, going, "Oh fuck, oh shit, no, I want them to be an accountant or to work in actuary," or yeah. And I know this because I get a lot of emails, lads. I get a lot of emails from ye and people just saying, I work in finance and I really love art so much, but I work in finance to please my parents and I'm very unhappy and I really just want to paint. I get a lot of those emails. So yeah, there would be certain parents who would actively discourage their children when they show signs of creativity, but maybe not do it in a nasty way. Maybe more of a That's class. But have you seen this ledger? Do you like money? Here's a fiver. But you know, beyond parental approval of your early creative efforts, I think there's another factor. I think it's when you go to school and you start comparing yourself to other children and their creative efforts, and you go into school and you think you're enjoying your crayon, you're drawing with your crayons and you're enjoying your colouring in, and then there's another student in the class and they're just fucking ridiculously good, and then maybe the teacher gives them praise, and then we decide, no, this isn't for me. I was on the opposite. I was the student in the class whereby when I did go in, it was like, wow, he's good at crayons. And that definitely reinforced, I don't know, my confidence over the years to decide I'm going to be an adult who does art professionally. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, all of us, do that for yourself. If you want to do something for yourself to improve your general well-being and to give yourself a greater sense of purpose or meaning, okay? Like, because it's winter now, so you're going to be spending more time indoors. Just do, invest in something a little bit creative. Paints, Lego, adult colouring book, bit of poetry, a model airplane, whatever the fuck. Something that ideally doesn't involve your phone or a laptop, and something that means kind of getting your hands dirty and messy and experiencing smells of paint or smells of glue or whatever. Do that for yourself and notice the sense of joy that'll come over you from simply doing it. And the only thing I'll say to you is banish the idea of this is going to be good or bad. Banish that. If that is present, then forget about it. Art should be about play, same way as it was when you were a child. Okay, so yeah, this week's podcast, it is going to be art related, but specifically history of art. And what I want to talk about is, I want to look at one or two artistic movements, specifically the painting leg of these movements. And I want to show ye how art reflects society, how artistic movements reflect whatever is going on in society at that point, whether it be intentional or not, just as a way to democratize art. I don't like people being intimidated by painting. I don't like people who walk into a gallery and start treating the gallery like it's a church and feeling that you look up at a painting on the wall and you go, I don't know why this painting is so great, but those other people who are really smart do, so I'm just going to pretend. Fuck that. That type of attitude is much more to do with the inflated monetary value that's been placed on art as a way to avoid tax than it has to do with actual art. All art, modern art, high art, Renaissance art, whatever the fuck you want, very easily accessible by anyone with a set of ears and a set of eyes. So that's what I'm going to talk about this week. A few artistic movements and how they were directly influenced by how they reflect the society and politics of the time. So I'm going to focus on painting specifically because it's the one I know most about in this context. So there's many, many different movements and periods throughout the last 1,000 years, we'll say, that define specific artistic movements. And when we hear these, like I said, if you're not initiated, if you haven't studied it or taken time to learn it, when we hear these terms, we can just switch off and go, this isn't for me. So what I want to try and do is democratize some of these movements and understand why they're fucking class, and why. What I really want to do is explain how each of these movements visually reflect the culture they operated in. What this podcast mainly will be about a movement called Rococo and a movement called Neoclassicism, which were both kind of around the 1700s, 1800s, both centred mainly around France in particular. In order to understand Rococo, firstly, I'm going to give a brief mention to what preceded the Rococo era. I'm going to talk about the Baroque period. Now, each of these movements, Baroque, Rococo, Neoclassicism, they encapsulate loads of shit. They encapsulate crafts, music, theatre, architecture, painting, landscaping, design. I'm going to focus on painting because painting tended to be, at that time, painting would have been the most important. Painting in the 1600s, 1700s was truly seen as something really magical and spiritual, in a way that sculpture was as well. Sculpture was too, but painting in particular, more so than architecture or design, painting was seen as a spiritual magic. It was seen as, I mean, you have to remember, lads, alright, so let's just go Baroque, okay, 16 fucking hundreds, Europe. Like, the average human being, we live in a media saturated society, so you and I are bombarded non-stop with 2D images of 3D things. Like, we take it for granted. Like, the 20th century and the 21st century, we see video, photographs, illustrations, cartoons non-stop. That's our life. So, you know, right now we inhabit a world that's almost the exact opposite of someone in the 1600s. You know, we have a compartmentalized reality where we have our online reality, where we live kind of virtually in a screen, and then our everyday actual reality. But you need to step back into a fucking society where people didn't see pictures very often. Like, there wasn't newspapers in the 1600s. 1600s, I believe, it was after the printing press. So the emerging middle classes and stuff would have had access to the odd print. But most people, you wouldn't come across posters or images or anything, really. Maybe once a month if you were fucking lucky. So visual culture wasn't a huge part. Depending on the church you went to. If you were a peasant, if you were lucky, maybe your church had one or two paintings that represented a religious fucking thing. But often people would have encountered folk art. And by which I mean folk art is that it wouldn't have been seen as high art. It would have been more design. Take, for instance, England in the 1600s. Like, you know, we don't seem to have this tradition in Ireland. I don't know why. Maybe we did and we just got rid of it when we got rid of the Brits. But if you go around England, especially around the villages, do you know the way their pubs have mad names like the King's Head or the Dog and Duck or the Fox and Hound, right? And all the English pubs are called that, and you're wondering, what the fuck, what are the Brits doing calling their pubs these things? Like, we just have, like, O'Riordan's and Sons. We name our pubs after family names. But in England, the dog and duck and the horse and... We've the horse and hound actually in Limerick. We do, yes, we do actually have this in Ireland. In Limerick, we have a pub called the Horse and Hound. So yes, it did exist here too, obviously. So... yeah, let's just take the horse and hound in Limerick as an example. Now, I don't know how old the horse and hound is, but in Britain, you will have pubs that will go back hundreds and hundreds of years. So the reason the Brits would call their pub the dog and duck or the horse and hound is people couldn't read. Like in 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, people lived at home, and if you had any bit of money and you went travelling, you'd stay at an inn or a tavern, or you might go for a pint in a pub or whatever. And these were the conduits between villages where people would visit, okay? But people couldn't read. So what it would mean is that if you were asking for directions, because people could obviously, they could communicate with words, but most people couldn't read, you'd say, where's the nearest tavern? And you'd say to the person giving directions, go into that village over there and you're going to find a building, and on the front of it there's a little painting of a dog and a duck, and that then becomes known as the dog and duck, because the dog and duck didn't have the words dog and duck outside it, because in the 1600s most people couldn't read. So you have, even today in Limerick, the horse and hound, it says the horse and hound, but there's also a little painting of a horse and a hound. So that's kind of where visual culture is at in the 1600s, in the Baroque period, as we call it. The vast majority of people not really having access to incredible paintings, unless you went to the dog and duck and you saw folk art, which was someone's best efforts at drawing a dog and a duck. I don't think many of these signs exist, because they would have been on wood. Or if you were lucky, you went to the, you know, the chapel in your village or the cathedral might have had some art. And art was truly used as a magical type of communion with God. If you're visually starved in the culture that you live in, and you see a fucking shit hot painting of Christ up on the cross, And you don't have a TV to look at, you don't have a smartphone, that's going to knock you off your fucking socks. That's going to make you come back to church every day. To be just the simplicity of seeing a something so dramatic and something so realistic on a 2D surface, when you live your entire life in 3D, that would baffle the brain. Like, the thing with art and painting, you can't teach a person how to draw or how to paint, right? You can teach the odd little technique or whatever, but ultimately, in academic painting, as you call it, for someone to begin the journey of, I'm going to become somebody who is able to draw and paint, what you're learning is not so much techniques with your hand, but you're training your brain to see differently. You can only teach someone how to see, okay? And the complexity of, you know, taking something in the real world, three-dimensional space, and then your brain translating that into a two-dimensional flat surface, like, that's fucking huge. Now, for us, in our media-saturated society, where we exist alongside two-dimensional images the whole time, it's not that much of a great leap for us. You know, like, right now, you can fucking take out your phone right now, and you can take a selfie, and it's like, you know, you look into the mirror and essentially the mirror is a 3D reflection. So it's still 3D. Or you go to your friend and there they exist in real life, three dimensions. And then you whip out your phone, you take a photograph, boom, 2 seconds, they're translated to a two-dimensional flat surface. Okay? With perspective, with, like, to someone in the 1600s, that's a massive leap. That is a huge fucking leap. Our visual culture allows us to access the 3D to 2D journey very easily and quite often. Someone in the 1600s, not a chance. That's why things like perspective needed to be discovered. Perspective simply being that thing in the, like, It's the Father Ted thing, right? Perspective start... We only start seeing perspective in paintings. And this is well before the Baroque period that I'm talking about now. I'm talking 1600s. We only started seeing perspective in paintings in the 1100s, the 1200s, with artists like Giotto and Paolo Uccello. And simply perspective was... I think it was Paolo Uccello had a painting of a battle around 1210, and he had the genius idea of, I'm going to paint the trees in the background smaller, and when they're smaller they will look far away. And Paolo Uccello did that in the 1200s, and that was like, it was like the internet being discovered. Like, it was fucking huge, because if you look at cave paintings that could be 30,000 years old, they're very flat, two-dimensional images, but you don't have perspective. You don't have something like as complex as three-dimensional distance existing on a flat surface. You don't see that in cave paintings. You start to see that in the 1100s, 1200s with Paolo Uccello and early, what I call them, Byzantine painters. So anyway, back to the fucking Baroque period, the 1600s. So... yeah, what was I getting onto? I was trying to explain how painting is a religious, spiritual, genuine type of magic to the average person in the 1600s. Not just to the average person, to the painter themselves, to the painter's patron, to kings, to queens, to fucking merchants. Painting is a true magic, and if you possess the gift and ability to paint great pictures, you are seen as possessing a type of magic, which at the time is not, it's a gift. It's where we get the term fucking gift from, or genius, or enlightened. It's God is travelling through the fucking artist. That's what people genuinely believed at the time. So what Baroque painting is, and Baroque painting, it'd be one of my favourite types of painting, to be honest. Before the Baroque period of the 1600s, we had the Renaissance. Okay, now the Renaissance you'd be quite familiar with. Very quickly, what was the Renaissance? It was when Western European culture left the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, and certain painters and artists and scientists started to rediscover ideas from... it was a Renaissance of Greek and Roman ideas. They started to look at the sculptures the Greeks and the Romans were doing and going, fuck, that was class, let's have a crack at that again. Because this medieval art is fucking terrible. Like, Giotto in the 1100s and Paolo Uccello, like, they, you know, represented perspective. But art of the Byzantine period in 1100, 1200, 1300, it's really shit. There isn't perspective. There's not a lot of skill at all. It really was a time of intellectual poverty, do you know? But the Renaissance, it was the rebirth of classical ideas, blah, blah, blah. We come out of this, we get the likes of Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Donatello, the Turtles, right? The real important painters. But Baroque comes after the Renaissance. And Baroque, it takes, like, everything the Renaissance painters, the confidence that the Renaissance painters, that, like, the huge advancement in Renaissance painting with the perspective, shading, colour theory, all this stuff, fucking the use of oil paint. We see this absolutely flourishing in the 1600s with Baroque painting. But what is Baroque painting? So, in order to understand Baroque painting, you need to understand Europe of the 1600s. And a massive thing that had happened in the 1500s, obviously, the Age of Discovery, let's not call it that, the age of brutal colonization of people who happened to live in fucking North and South America who were eradicated. Let's not say the Age of Discovery, please. That's my Western brain. But that, and also Protestantism, the Protestant Reformation happens in the 1500s, right? And the thing with the Renaissance is that you had wealthy patrons, Florentine cunts from Italy, who had a load of money, and they became patrons of the arts, and they would basically give loads of money to artists and painters to go paint a brilliant fucking painting there of Holy Mary, will you? And then I'll get into heaven, right? And the Pope will think I'm class. And that was the deal. It's like, if you were wealthy in the Renaissance, if you had a load of money, you filled, you gave Michelangelo and Leonardo and Donatello, you gave them loads of money to paint religious things. And because the Catholic Church at the time was so corrupt, and there was a thing within Catholicism called indulgences, whereby the church had gone so far fucking removed from the ideas of Christ 1500 years previously, that Catholics in the 1500s were like, I can buy my way to heaven. Because you have to, it wasn't like today where most people are like, look, this God business is probably bullshit, heaven is probably bullshit. Back then people really believed it, really and truly believed it, and believed that artists were a type of, that they believed that God moved and Jesus moved through the fucking artists, and that's how they had this ability to create these amazing 2D representations of real life and these biblical scenes, alright? So, wealthy people were giving money to artists to create as much religious art as possible, to make it as beautiful as possible, to adore and worship and grace not only God and Christ, but also to win favour with the fucking, the popes and the cardinals who had the real power. Okay, so it was a bit of that too. So Renaissance art became quite theatrical, quite emotional, epic. You know, most definitely it became fucking epic. These huge paintings that depicted things from the Garden of Eden. You know, the Sistine fucking chapel, lads. God and Adam. You know, Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. It became epic, dramatic. Fucking Steven Spielberg, Michael Bay, carry on. And then the Protestant Reformation happens in the 1500s. And the whole shtick with the Protestant Reformation is that Protestantism came about, quite simply, because it was one chapel, Martin Luther, just going, the Catholic Church is after fucking running away with itself. The popes and cardinals are having gangbangs, which they were. Popes are starting wars. Rich people can buy their way into heaven. They're spending all this money on fucking art. It's Catholicism, and Christianity has become this overindulgent, opulent, corrupt, ridiculous perversion of Christ's teachings. And anyone who subscribed to that idea, who were protesting the irrationality and silliness of where Christianity and Catholicism was, anyone who protested that became a Protestant. Okay, they were protesting it. And from Protestantism, you get like Lutheranism and fucking Calvinism. But at the core of Lutheranism and Calvinism is they reject everything that Catholicism was doing, in particular the visual extravagance of Catholicism. So Protestant churches, you know, like, churches were fucking like full of this gorgeous fucking art with gold and jewels and giant windows and to let God's light in, and they were very expensive affairs that were supposed to bring about awe, shock and beauty to the congregation, right? So artists, architects, sculptors were flying it during the Renaissance, essentially building using art to create fucking power, so that the average person walks into the person who's the only art they see is a fucking dog and a duck in a pub, walks into a cathedral and goes, wow, this is fucking amazing. This is so beyond anything I can even imagine. It must be the work of God, and therefore you have power. So Protestantism was like, fuck that shit. If the Catholics have these giant expensive churches where all they give a fuck about is showing off and bling and gold, then our churches are going to be the exact opposite. Protestant churches became a really a really boring grey box with pews, with very little art, very little windows, just a very simple church their diets became simple. Like, this is probably going a few hundred years more, but I'm pretty sure Protestants invented cornflakes as a way to stop wanking. But basically, Protestantism became about visual simplicity, austerity, paring things back, abstaining from pleasure, okay? Abstain from fucking sex, abstain from overeating, abstain from drinking too much, and abstain from the visual stimulation of beautiful fucking art, the visual stimulation of epic art. This was seen as an indulgence and showing off in the same way that it was a sin, essentially, within Protestantism. So what Baroque art is, Baroque art starts to go, okay, so the Protestants are now rebelling against the excesses of, the visual excesses of Catholicism. So what Baroque art is it's Catholic funded art kind of turning the level up five times as much. So Baroque art is fucking fantastic. Some of my favourite artists are Baroque artists operating in the 1600s. Caravaggio, Velasquez, Rembrandt, some of the finest fucking paintings ever created, okay? And this is Baroque art. It's an aggressive response to Protestant austerity and minimalism. If the Protestants want to worship in a fucking box with one window, then we're going to create epic paintings of religious scenes, way better than the Renaissance carry on. We're going to bring a degree of realism to it and really make them colourful and brilliant. With the exception of Caravaggio, of course, like I mentioned on the previous podcast, Caravaggio, as a Baroque painter, did not use a lot of colour, because to use colour is to spend a lot of money. Pigments were expensive. So Caravaggio, 90% of his paintings are black, but then with a single light down the middle where the colour is centred around the middle, with these giant paintings. Caravaggio was also a criminal and a murderer. My personal theory, I think Caravaggio was taking a commission for 10 grand, spending 500 quid on paint. Black is one of the cheapest paints going, and I think he was saving money and then spending the rest on fucking hookers and drink, alright? But the importance of Caravaggio is, like I said earlier, okay, you can't teach someone how to paint, you can only teach someone how to see. By which I mean, before you learn how to see as a painter, when you look at a field, language gets in the way of seeing. You go, grass is green, therefore the field is green. But a painter knows, no, today that field might be purple depending on the light of the sun. So to become a painter and become an artist, you have to train your brain to move beyond language and to see things as they actually are. And you remove grass is green, roads are black. Do you know what I mean? But Caravaggio, and but not just Caravaggio, Baroque painting in general, it not only had these incredibly dramatic, emotion-filled biblical scenes, it, from an academic and technical point of view, it's some of the fucking most amazing oil paintings you'll ever see, where real human models were used. Caravaggio would have been the rebel, because what Caravaggio would do is, because he lived a life of vice and he was hanging out with crooks and criminals and prostitutes, sex workers, sorry, what you had is, he used to get in a lot of trouble, because he would get like some lad he'd been on the fucking on the lash with for 2 weeks, who stinks of whiskey, and Caravaggio would get him to pose to be Christ, and he'd paint his dirty fingernails. And at the time, some people were like, "You're painting Christ a little bit too human there. I don't think Christ would have looked like he had a 3-day fucking hangover, Caravaggio." But that is it's the real, it's the birth of fucking realism. It's the birth of grittiness. Do you know? Rembrandt, incredible fucking painter, did some of the most amazing self-portraits you'll ever see. Velasquez, similarly. But these were Baroque painters. And like I said, Baroque was responding to Protestant austerity and minimalism. So what I want to get on to... Fuck, we'll do an ocarina pause. 40 minutes in. Ocarina pause. All right. An advert for something you didn't need probably went in.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There. Support from this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page. I was talking there about patrons of the arts, okay? You can be the patron of my art if you so choose. If you met me in real life, would you have a pint with me? Would you have a coffee with me? Would you buy me that pint? Well, you can do that once a month, alright? This is what keeps the podcast going. The reason I'm always pushing for the Patreon every single week is some people come and some people go, so I have to keep pushing at it. Please, if you can afford it and you like the podcast, you're enjoying it, sign up to the Patreon page and give me the price of a pint once a month. Patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast, alright? If you can't afford it, you don't have to. It's grand. Also, like the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, leave a review of the podcast, share the podcast with friends, share it on Twitter, on Facebook, or just tell someone about it. This all helps me. Yart. Okay. So we were talking about Baroque, 1600s. And Baroque was incredible. It was fucking amazing. Theatrical, emotional, epic, but most importantly, damn fine fucking academic art. Incredible technical skill, ability, use of paint, use of colour. Real fucking good art, okay? And that's the 1600s. So let's start going to the 1700s. Baroque starts to turn into, in France in particular, a new type of art called Rococo. Rococo, lads, if you don't mind me saying, is fucking shit. Rococo, in my opinion, it's one of the worst periods of visual art, of painting, in the fucking, in the last 1,000 years. It really was, and it came from Baroque painting. And the problem with Rococo is, it took, if Baroque, like I said, was about drama, emotion, epic, all these things, theatre, it took all that shit, but then it didn't take the realism, it didn't take the idealism, it didn't take the technical skill, the paint, the ability. It discarded that and just hung on to the kind of the emotional elements. I'll tell you, if you want to see the closest transition. So, Baroque is mid-2000s HBO TV box sets. Rococo is Netflix. So if you look at, we had a golden age of television in the mid-2000s. We had The Sopranos, we had Oz, we had The Wire, 6 Feet Under, right? This huge explosion in the 2000s, mainly centered around the channel HBO, where all of a sudden, television was on par, if not having more integrity than cinema for the first time ever. Like, before HBO, good shit, like films that told amazing stories, that were technically brilliant, that fucking touched on the human condition, this only happened in the cinema. Like the work of Martin Scorsese, something like Taxi Driver, who he himself explicitly was influenced by Caravaggio, and he'd be the first one to say it. HBO in the mid-2000s, lads, was baroque. It had all the epic drama and cinematography of like Scorsese, but also the gritty realism, amazing writing, and a commentary on the human condition. And this is present in, like I said, Sopranos, The Wire, fucking 6 Feet Under, Oz, all this. But then Netflix comes along. The thing about Netflix, right? 90% of everything on Netflix is fucking shit. What Netflix did is, Netflix borrowed, so Netflix has box set television. And you know, Netflix does come out with some original series, and they're good, right? They're fucking great. But 90% of it is fucking shit. And what they've done is they took the feeling of mid-2000s box sets. They took the cinematography, the use of soundtracks, the use of lighting, the fact that it feels like cinema, yet it's long episodic content. They took all these beats from mid-2000s HBO box sets, but then started rolling them out in a cookie cutter format as Netflix original content. But what they don't have, quality of writing, quality of acting, they don't comment upon the human condition in a deep way. Not all, but a lot. Because Netflix churns it out. So that right there is the difference between baroque and rococo. So rococo comes about in the 1700s. So if baroque reflects a society that is openly rebelling in glorious fashion against the minimalism and austerity of Protestantism, rococo starts to represent, it stands for fucking nothing. Rococo represents opulence and rich fuckers wanking off into bushes. Like, the most telling thing about rococo is that the name means nothing. It truly means nothing. There was another French word called Raquel or something like that, that had something to do with art, that looked like, that was based on seashells. But rococo means nothing. It's a made up word. It's like the word selfie. Before I continue, if you're, because I'm conscious, I'm trying to do a visual art kind of stream of consciousness chat here, but it's happening in a purely oral format. So if you want to get an idea of what 1700s rococo art looked like, before I continue on to it, I'll tell you the most famous rococo painting, and you most definitely have seen this. I guarantee you know it, because it would be one of the most famous paintings in the world. And get a look at it, and then I'll explain to you why it's shit. Fragonard. So Jean Fragonard, Fragonard, and the painting is called The Swing. Fragonard's The Swing. That would be the quintessential rococo painting. So because this podcast is about how visual art and painting reflects the society that it comes from, let's take a look at the post-baroque society that rococo flourishes in. So we spoke about the emergence of Protestantism, but also the age of brutal, quote-unquote, the age of discovery, the age of brutal colonialism. Okay, so let's focus on France. France is a major colonial power. France, by the 1600s, 1700s, has stretched its fingers outward throughout the world, taking big chunks of Africa, the Middle East, fucking Canada, the West Indies, down around South America. Basically, the world that rococo painting comes into, it's colonialism, which is essentially like in European countries, there's always like the monarchy and the papacy and nobles and shit like that. They were always wealthy. There was always a class of incredibly wealthy people and then peasants underneath. But colonialism brought forward a new level of wealth, an unseen level of wealth. Because colonialism at its root, what it is, it's the brutal, vicious extraction of wealth and resources from colonized lands and then transferring those wealth and resources to European countries, which essentially makes the clergy and the monarchy and the fucking, what do you call them, the posh cunts that aren't monarch, the elites, it makes them incredibly wealthy. So in France, 1600s, 1700s, let's start with the king Louis XIV, because it kind of starts with him. Louis XIV becomes disgustingly wealthy, and so do the nobles. They become a level of wealth unseen because of colonialism, because quite simply, a lot of gold, a lot of resources, they're just robbing from countries far, far bigger than France. So it's the roots of the privileges that you and I enjoy today. You know, you and I live like Louis XIV did in the 1600s, just as a given, because of how we as a society still to this day exploit and extract resources from countries that we take it from. But anyway, so Louis the fucking 14th, he's an absolute monarch, right? He's pure and utter, I am fucking king, and that is it. And a king can do whatever the fuck they want, and a king is entitled to whatever they want. So Louis the 14th, France, if you don't have any money, if you're a peasant in France under Louis the 14th, then you don't have a particularly good life, because Louis the 14th is just looking out for Louis, and importantly his nobles. Because even though a king has, as we've learned from King John, do you know, with the Magna Carta, a king can be as much of a prick as he wants and have as much money as he wants, but you have to look after your nobles. But what happens is, Louis the 14th, he was king of France for 74 years, and he died at 76, so he was king of France since he was 2. Longest ever king of any fucking European nation. So Louis the 14th, very entitled, aristocratic, but what he did, right, and he was very much about centralised power, that France should be run from one place, and one place in particular for Louis, it was the Palace of Versailles. And the Palace of Versailles was this gigantic aristocratic compound of utter royalty with very high walls, and you know, it was where the 1% lived. They lived like billionaires, and everything outside the Palace of Versailles did not live like that. And what Louis did too is, so previously you'd have had, you know, French nobility, dukes, fucking, I don't even know the language they use, but dukes and whatever the fuck, other types of royalty that aren't king or queen, all these rich cousins and whatever. This is, you know, I'm glad I know fuck all about monarchies. This is the opposite of British people not knowing anything about colonialism, or French people not knowing. I know fuck all about monarchy. So the king and other wealthy people who are also royal would have previously lived in duchies. Is that what they call them? They'd have been all over France. Okay, in different parts. Normandy, Avignon, whatever the fuck. But Louis goes, lads, I want all my nobles in the same place. So he actively, throughout his kingship, in 74 years or whatever it was, encourages all the nobles to move to the Palace of Versailles. They start abandoning their lands as such, you know, having absentee landlords. So now you have, by the time of Louis XIV's death, this ridiculous amount of wealth concentrated only around the Palace of Versailles. And it becomes completely centralized politically, economically, and culturally. So Rococo starts, really, it's with Louis the 14th's fucking death. And then Louis the 15th comes along. Louis the fucking 15th becomes king at the age of 5. He was Louis the 14th's grandson. He becomes regent at the age of 5. A regent is, it's when you're officially like king or queen, but like you're too young to run the country. So someone else, some duke was effectively ruling while Louis the 15th was shitting his pants. So when Louis the 15th becomes 13 years of age, then he's king of France. So Rococo begins with him because Louis the 15th. Now, the other thing as well that's actually very important is, so Louis the 15th there, right? So he gets, he's regent from the age of 5 to 13. And that's almost a decade where there's no king as such. Instead, this duke or whatever has taken over responsibility. So what happens during this decade period, his granddad, Louis the 14th, was this absolute monarch. But you've 10 years with no king. So a lot of the cultural focus and power shifts more to the aristocrats that are hanging around the palace instead of one king. And that there, I think that's like the birth of Rococo right there. But then Louis the 15th becomes 13 and he becomes king, and then continues on the opulent centralized traditions of his granddad, where everything is focused around a small amount of incredibly rich dickheads in the planet, in the Palace of Versailles, who the walls get higher and they slowly, they haven't a clue what's going on in the rest of France, and they have too much money and all the gold is coming in from Africa and from the West Indies, and they live lives of wealth so extreme that it's meaningless wealth. And taking it back to that painting that I spoke about, Fragonard, the swing, Rococo art is this highly decorative, unrealistic shite that it doesn't reflect like anything to do with the human condition. It's Rococo art is like it's in influencers' Instagram. It reflects only this kind of make-believe life of romantic excess that's only experienced by the small degree of royalty in France. It has lost all connection with humility, the human condition, real people's lives, or even the humility of religion. Rococo art is notably, and it's quite strange for art around the 1600s, there's no religious connotations, because at that time, they'd gone beyond that. This was the time of libertinism. It's like Rococo art, it's an influencer culture. It's, do you know that weird period in rap music? Late 90s after Tupac and Biggie got shot. Late 90s, 2000s before the recession, when rap music became obsessed with bling culture, and all rappers rapped about was popping bottles of Cristal and how many gold chains they have. Rococo was bling. It was meaningless, hedonistic kind of scenes of the opulent lives that the rich people in the palace of Versailles lived, and it didn't reflect at all any type of reality. And like I said, taking it back to Baroque, I mean, you can make the argument of religious scenes similarly are also a level of fantasy. A lot of Caravaggio's paintings are fantasy. They're very dramatic. You know, the Baroque paintings now 100 years previously. Lots of drama, biblical scenes that never happened. So yes, it's still fantasy. Focusing not on excess, but penance, pain, suffering. Rococo, there's no penance or pain in Rococo. Instead, it's excesses. You know, Fragonard's The Swing. This, you know, incredibly stylized posh bird with a beehive fucking hair on a swing and her lover on the ground in this idyllic garden. That's what Rococo was. But what makes Rococo shit is it had abandoned all academic principles of art. So what I mean is, in Baroque art, at least Caravaggio was painting real models. He was painting real things. He was using the human eye to translate 3D into a two-dimensional space. Rococo wasn't like that. If you look at how the trees are painted in Fragonard's painting, those trees never existed in real life. The artist didn't sit down and look at a tree and try and translate that onto a page. They didn't reflect and absorb the beauty and randomness of nature. What you're seeing instead is someone painting a garden from memory. Look at how little of the leaves on the trees, they're not real leaves, they're just a technique stubbling on the canvas. Overly, even like there's slight references to, like in the Renaissance you'd reference back to Greek and Roman art. You see that sometimes in fucking Rococo painting, but what they're referencing is, what are those angels called with their babies? Cherubs. A lot of cherubs and Cupid shit. And but most of all, they're just bad paintings. It leans much more towards decoration than it does fine art. Sometimes the people in the paintings may not have even existed. They could have been people that were simply drawn from memory rather than a person who posed. So it's a period of art where it's frivolity, bling, decorative shit is placed far, far above anything else to do with art. So that's why it's kind of, it's crappy art when you compare it to what has gone before and what comes afterwards. But most offensive of all about Rococo painting is, this is a time when, you know, we're on to Louis the fucking 15th at this stage, and then Louis the 16th, like, it's before the French Revolution. So the upper classes are living in the Palace of Versailles in this incredible opulence, absorbing in the excesses of the colonies, and meanwhile the people outside the high walls, the regular people of France, are really suffering. You know, France has one or two bad years with tax, or sorry, with crops and shit like that. So they start introducing taxes, but the taxes only tax the poor and don't tax the rich. So you have a society that's ready to fucking crumble, that's ready to boil over, and ready for a fucking revolution. But meanwhile, all the rich people are in the Palace of Versailles, and the art that is being, that they're commissioning, that they're asking for, that they're asking to be created from, it's Instagram influencer shit. It says nothing. There's no greater meaning behind it. It's just like someone with a photograph of their latte and a perfect sunlight coming in. It's not real. It's reality television. Everything today that you can look at in culture, that's all, it's only about aesthetics and image and making other people feel like shit. Like that's like influencer culture. I understand it's fine and people like to follow influencers, but ultimately what it's about is it's bragging about a fake life that you have in order, and we watch it and we think we feel inspired, but we don't. We just feel it's someone else just reminding you that they're living a better life than you are, and we try and aspire to it, but ultimately it brings our mood down. That's what Rococo art was. And it became gaudy and highly decorative and bling. Someone with too much money and no taste. All of that shit, you trace it right back, the roots of it, to Rococo. You look at how Donald Trump, you look at Donald Trump's living quarters and Trump Towers, and you look at the spaces that Donald Trump decorates for himself in his own house. White walls with just this ridiculous gold all over the place. unwittingly Trump's fucking style that he prefers. Its roots can be traced to Rococo. He doesn't have a fucking clue about that, but it's the signifier of meaningless opulence and a libertine lifestyle. Libertines at the time, it was a culture in the 1700s, which was, again, based in France. I'll do a separate podcast on libertinism, but it was just rich little shits going, I'm going to dedicate my life only to pleasures of the senses. Only to pleasures of the senses. And that's what Rococo is. It's Rococo is cocaine. Rococo is a rich person at a party doing the best cocaine they can find and talking fucking shit. That's what Rococo is. And it reflects, like I said, France at the time. Louis XIV, Louis XV. Like, Louis XIV, like I said, he was the one who was like, took this colonial wealth and said, let's everyone with money live in the palace of Versailles. By the time it gets to Louis XV, who was made king at the age of 5, he has no context for anything other than that. So it's a true meaninglessness. And I don't want to sound excessively mean on Rococo art. Like, artists like Fragonard or Watteau, like, all they're doing is, like, an artist has to earn a living, and an artist in the 1600s, they have to paint what their fucking patron is asking them for. So Baroque painters were mostly being commissioned by the church or people who wanted to impress the church, and they were looking for, I need epic biblical scenes with incredible technical ability, because people will associate your technical ability with a spirituality. Right? Rococo wasn't like that. Rococo was very dull, rich people who lived an existence of only indulgence with zero experience of suffering, hardship, or regular people. And they were now doing the commissioning, and they're going to talented artists like Watteau and Fragonard, and they're saying, just fucking paint a paint. I'd say they sat down with Fragonard and Watteau and said, last week, me and the lads went to the meadow in the Palace of Versailles, and we had a fucking huge orgy and got pissed drunk, and then someone did a shit into the lake, and then we killed a swan with a rock, and then we killed a servant. Ha ha ha. Paint that. Here's 10 grand. That would have been Rococo. So these talented artists, when your clients are in that way and don't have any desire for realism or anything like that, the painter is just simply going to go, well, this fucking idiot who's pissed all the time, he doesn't want me to go outside and paint a real tree, so I'm going to paint trees from my imagination. And I'm going to paint skies from my imagination. And the leaves and the trees are not going to be real leaves. They'll just be daubs of my brush. And I paint him and his friends just wanking each other off. Grand. And you get what you pay for. So that's why Rococo is the way it is. It was a small number of fucking dopes with too much of everything doing the commissioning. And ultimately, the great failing of Rococo art and painting is, like I said there, because of who was commissioning it. It was truly blind to the actual realities of French society. And not only blind, but like it flew in the face of the realities of French society. French society, if you weren't one of the incredibly rich people living in the Palace of Versailles, or Versailles, you were living in serious hardship. Living in poverty, not only living in poverty, but experiencing quite harsh taxes, while the rich are not getting taxed at all. They're inventing, they're living in opulent lifestyles of non-stop partying, and reflecting this in their shit art. So, I mean, again, to draw a modern analogue, and I do think this, if you look at elements of our culture now, like, let's just take influencer culture again. The average influencer with their daily Instagram posts of their unrealistic body that they've changed with Photoshop and their lifestyle that doesn't exist, of continual partying, and like, there's a guy on Instagram called Dan Bilzerian who is a multi-millionaire, and all he does is take photographs all day on yachts and swimming pools with loads of gorgeous models, and it's completely fake, but like 13-year-old boys follow this Dan Bilzerian fella to look at his unrealistic non-stop sex partying lifestyle on Instagram, and he's an influencer. Like, that's rococo. But if you look at right now, like, okay, the biggest thing that's facing us, our society right now, is climate change. The reality of climate change, and that if we don't act, it's going to bite us in the fucking hoop. You know, in 100 years, assuming anyone's fucking left to look back, will they view, like, reality TV, influencer culture, this blind, opulent ode to consumption, this visual ode to consumption, that's what influencer culture is, this happening at the same time as the climate has fallen apart, will we look at it the same way? Because that's certainly what rococo was. Because what fucking ended rococo? Rococo ended when the French Revolution happened, when the people of France, now I'm going to simplify the fuck out of this, but when the people of France rose up and demanded a republic, and they rose up because of the non-stop partying and ignorance of these aristocrats in the Palace of Versailles with the rococo art, that just rubbed salt in the wounds of the average person in France who was just like, fuck that, we're tearing down the walls. And people, the aristocrats, were beheaded. They were given the guillotine. And that was the end of rococo. And rococo exists as this clueless snapshot as to what was really happening in French society. And the French Revolution happens in 1798, but the artistic cracks start to appear slightly before 1798. With different artists, mainly the one that sticks out for me, an English artist who I've done a podcast on before, William Hogarth. Hogarth, I don't know where to place Hogarth. I don't know what is he. I think realism. He's certainly not rococo. Hogarth, interesting character. Again, this is happening in England, but so Hogarth starts to paint paintings. And a series of paintings. So it's almost like a TV box set. Of, he's reflecting the new ills that are falling upon in society because it's becoming industrialized. So Hogarth has, you know, very realistic scenes. But also they're satirical. They're not, yeah, okay, so here's the deal. You can replace William Hogarth's stuff in the ballpark of rococo, because visually Hogarth is not about academic painting. Like I said earlier with the paintings of Fragonard and rococo paintings, where we say the trees that are in the painting are not real trees, they're trees from the artist's imagination. Like Hogarth stuff is closer to cartoons. Like rococo is, it's illustration, it's some of the characters in the paintings exist in the artist's mind rather than in real life. They're not painting and drawing models. Nor was Hogarth, essentially. He'd have done a couple of studies. But what Hogarth did, he took elements of rococo aesthetic but brought in fucking satire. Rococo did not have satire. It did not have irony. It was about indulgence and celebration and opulence and cluelessness. But Hogarth, in England now, starts to do these satirical paintings that reflect, he starts to bring in a moralism, probably based on, it's almost like a response to Baroque, because Hogarth, I believe, was Protestant. So he brings in a kind of a moralism, and Hogarth's drawings, like, he's got a series of paintings called The Journey of a Rake, I think it's called. Is it The Journey of a Rake? And a rake would be a rake. Okay, put it this way. So a rake would be an aristocrat. It'd be someone who inherited a lot of wealth. So a rake would be the type of rich prick who's in the Palace of Versailles living a continual party lifestyle. So Rococo is only reflecting the opulence of this rake's life with no consequences. But Hogarth is over in England doing these paintings that are borrow aesthetically a little bit from Rococo, but he has like a series of paintings called The Journey of the Rake, and it's a series of like 7 paintings, and it tells a story almost like a comic book. And the paintings are like, here's this young rich man, and he inherits a fuckload of money from his dad, and it's him inheriting this at a young age. Then painting number 2 is like this young rake at a party, fucking pissed. Then painting number 3 is him in a brothel with a bunch of sex workers around him. And it shows his utter indulgence, and this rake only cares about his own pleasure and his own sensual desires. And then by painting number 4, this rake has lost his money, so now he finds an older widower and marries her for her money, but then he spends all that. And it finishes with the rake in the well-known mental asylum in London called Bedlam, and he's basically at the end of his life. So Hogarth has taken from the Rococo style, but satirically has a moral story behind it, which is, if you live the Rococo lifestyle, you'll end up a washed up old alcoholic, which is what was happening in France in the Palace of Versailles, but it wasn't reflected in the art. So Hogarth's doing this, okay? Then you had another chap, and the other important thing about Hogarth was smart. So he'd do these paintings, right? But not everyone can afford a painting. But in England and in France, you have an emerging middle class that's happening because of the Industrial Revolution, the bourgeoisie. And these are people who are new money. They would have come from poverty, but because they either bought a factory or whatever the fuck, they now have access to a bit of money, and they want to now buy art. But they can't afford fucking paintings like the aristocrats have, but they can afford prints. So Hogarth starts to get his, like, a rake's progress, or another one he has is a harlot's progress, or he has paintings like Gin Alley, which I did a podcast on, and he starts transferring these as prints, and people now can, the bourgeoisie, like middle class people in the 1700s, can start buying his fucking prints and having them in their gaffs, do you know? And he's the first one to really start doing that, to opening up his art to capitalism like that. And in fact, copywriting, the Copyright Act, I might be wrong, but I'm nearly sure the Copyright Act in England, the first ever proper one, was brought in because people were counterfeiting Hogarth's work. So the idea of intellectual property around art legally starts with Hogarth and his prints. So you're seeing this, you're seeing the, like, the failings of Rococo reflected in the work of Hogarth in England. You're seeing it a little bit in France too. There's a fella, Chardin was his name, and what Chardin was doing is that it wasn't satirical. Like, Hogarth was clearly taking a swipe at aristocrats and saying, if you live a life of opulence and ignore everything around you, life is going to come back and get you. Not even God. Like you're not going to, not even hell or anything. It's like, if you ride everything around you, drink everything around you, eat everything around you, you will eventually end up unwell. And that's what Hogarth was doing. This is not happening in Rococo art, but there was a fella called Chardin, late 1700s, and he was painting not in the Rococo style, something closer to mannerism or realism. And he was, I'll tell you what Chardin was doing. He was painting what you'd call kitchen sink, right? In the 1950s and 60s in both America and Britain, in the theatres, this shit started coming around called kitchen sink drama, which was basically drama that centred around normal people's lives in their houses. And this happened on the theatre, but then reflected in the new technology of television in the 50s and 60s in America and England. So, like, EastEnders. you know, what the fuck is EastEnders and Coronation Street? It's people who are working class people who have enough money to afford a television, wanting to see their own lives reflected in the television. So this fella, Chardin, starts painting in the late 1700s while Rococo is going on, and he's now reflecting the lives of ordinary bourgeoisie, middle class, emerging middle class people in France, and just painting scenes of people at home, people sitting at tables with food on their tables and shit like that. Again, because the middle class is something new, the idea of simply having a table with food and objects and owning things in your house, that was quite aspirational, because 100 years previously you just had a peasant class and an aristocracy, and that's it. But now, by the time of the French Revolution, you now have a middle class, and this is a lot of the people who are fucking driving this revolution. So what eventually replaces Rococo? Like I said, I consider Hogarth and Chardin to be a little strange intermediary that signifies the end of Rococo but doesn't really reflect a new form. What replaces Rococo is a style called Neoclassicism. And Neoclassicism is the art of the French Revolution. The French Revolution is ideologically very much a return to political ideas that stem from Greek and Roman culture. The Republic, which is a Greek idea, and fucking democracy. Demos kratio, the people rule. Okay, so democracy and the Republic are the ideals of the French Revolution, eradicating the monarchy and a new way forward. The birth of fucking modernity as such, although in fairness, the French Revolution was inspired by the American Revolution, you know, but neoclassicism becomes the new dominant art form. There's no more, like, Rococo is spat upon as this opulent signifier of the oppressive class, and now you have a new type of art, which, if the ideals, and this is what I'm saying, how art, whether knowingly or unknowingly, reflects the ideals and what's going on in society. If the French Revolution is about looking back towards fucking Greek and Roman ideas, neoclassicism, aesthetically, as a style of painting, looks back aesthetically to Greek and Roman painting in the way that the Renaissance did too. And neoclassicism, who'd be the most prominent neoclassicist painter? Jacques-Louis David. His paintings, The Oath of the Hereti, or The Death of Marat. And what you see with neoclassicism is, it's really, like, gone are the design and the decoration and the frivolity and drawing from imagination that you see in Rococo. Now you're back to academic painting once again. The characters that appear in neoclassical paintings they're based on models. It doesn't have the emotive drama of Baroque paintings like Caravaggio, but it does have the realistic attention to detail and the use of paint, and they're much higher, they're technically of a much higher quality than Rococo paintings. But they're idealistic. They're quite serious. There's not a huge amount of humour in neoclassicism. They use, you know, as a high level of visual metaphor. One thing that led to the rise of neoclassicism too is, you have to remember, so we're talking late 1700s, early 1800s. Things open up in the world, you know. The concept of the Grand Tour. Like, okay, the Hellenic Islands, I think, Herculaneum, which is an ancient Greece site, I believe, on some islands, that was discovered and excavated. Like, archaeology becomes a thing. This is post-Enlightenment, so things like archaeology become a serious thing that people do with their time. So you have fucking Pompeii is discovered in Italy and excavated. So, and loads of books and shit and really detailed drawings of every aspect of Pompeii are made. So neoclassical artists have greater visual access, in the way that the Renaissance painters didn't, to what structures and society actually looked like in Greek and Roman times. You also had the emergence of a cultural phenomenon known as the Grand Tour, where young men, it was usually men of wealth or bourgeoisie, at the ages where you'd normally go to college, we'll say from 18 to 23, what they would do is they would go on a grand tour, which meant that they would travel certain designated points around the world that were seen as hotspots of knowledge and culture. And Herculaneum, can't pronounce it, was one. Pompeii was another. I believe, I think Cordoba, where I visit in Spain, because that was an ancient Islamic caliphate, was on the list as well. But young men would travel the world and began to fetishize history. History, right, the recording and understanding and enjoyment of history is actually quite a new enough phenomenon. It's something that really comes to light with the Enlightenment of the 1700s and 1800s. Before that, I don't know, people had too much shit going on in their lives to be worrying about what people 1,000 years before were doing. People didn't have the reverence and respect and desire to understand and preserve artifacts. That starts happening 200 years ago. And neoclassicism comes from that. So you have the, with the physical, archaeological tenderness and respect that's been afforded somewhere like Pompeii, these ruins of a fucking Roman city that was buried under a volcano, this careful excavation and preservation and understanding that this is important, we must not destroy it. This now happens also to the ideas that would have been present in fucking Pompeii, which were the Republic, democracy, such and such, which is driving the French Revolution. So neoclassical art starts to reflect this. And Jacques-Louis David is who you want to look at for that stuff. And yeah, I do. I enjoy neoclassical art. I'd be more of a Baroque fan, but I'll take neoclassicism over Rococo, because the paintings are a pleasure to look at. They're a little bit stifled. They're a little bit serious. Neoclassicism then also influences architecture. Like, a lot of fucking buildings, a huge amount of central London is neoclassical in style. If you see any building that, like the US White House, which I believe was based on the Dublin Áras an Uachtaráin, where our president lives, any building at the front where they have large Roman columns is built in the neoclassical style. The fucking GPO. The GPO, O'Connell Street, Dublin, with its huge Roman pillars at the front, that is a neoclassical style of architecture. Whereas, not a lot of fucking Rococo. The Rotunda Hospital, elements of that would have been designed in the Rococo period and would contain Rococo elements. It's not like the full extravagance of, if you want to see like vomit inducing Rococo, you'd need to be going to France or fucking Vienna. But the Rotunda Hospital is like a stripped back Rococo, but GPO, certainly the front fucking facade, that's pure neoclassicism. So it's quite present in a lot of buildings that were built around the 1800s, a lot of London, shit like that. That's neoclassicism, the new classic. Ironically, I like to visit the British Museum a lot, you know, when I'm in London. And you have this building, which is itself is neoclassical. It's based, it's trying to look like an old Athenian temple 2,000 years ago. But in the building itself is the recreation of Greek ruins from Crete, you know. And I find that ironic that it's like the building that it's based upon is also the building that's housing it. But yeah, neoclassicism came afterwards. And just to wrap it up, that's what I'm getting at. It's like art, the way paintings look, the way architecture looks, it's reflecting whatever's going on politically or sociologically for the people. And it's not, sometimes it happens deliberately and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it just reflects the zeitgeist. And the zeitgeist is just a name that for the general feeling and mood in the air. And I view neoclassicism as, it's the first modernist art form, to be honest. In its ideals, in its relationship with things like science, political science. It's the tenets of neoclassicism are human rights, scientific investigation, the concept of rationality, the concepts of morality. It's an idealistic art form that does try and bring about change and hope. Rococo didn't. Rococo is like, look at this very long wank I'm having and paint it. Neoclassicism was like, we can do things differently because we have science and industry. And, you know, from that, in 20th century, another podcast, but we get fucking modernism. We get like fucking futurism and shit like that, you know, which I'll do a separate podcast on. All right, that was 90 minutes. There's not more I can say. God bless. Go fuck yourself. Talk to you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.